and at Carlisle, where John had the pleasure of teaching for a year after Desert Storm. If enemies, it made him think of the life of Robert E. Lee, who was somewhat of a namesake for his friend. Lee had served as superintendent at West Point in the early 1850s. 10 years later, more than one of his young cadets from West Point faced him across the other side in the fields of Antietam and Gettysburg, the burning woods of the wilderness, and the nightmare slaughter in front of Cold Harbor. After such blood-drenched fights, Lee would read in captured newspapers accounts of yet another of those young cadets' deaths, and knew deep within that the cause he fought for with such tenacity had resulted in those deaths. Is Bob my enemy or my friend? John now wondered. If my enemy, would he kill me? Or at least try to warn me at first? And was that the reason Quentin had been sent? Or, for that matter, is this all some sort of cruel, existentialist joke? A vibration running through the chopper snapped him out of his musing. What was that? He could see a look of concern now in Forrest's eyes, and those of Milady as well. Might be one of the turbines starting to break up, Forrest said calmly. I think I dozed off. Where are we? We passed Statesville on our left about 5 minutes ago, Forrest said. My God, it's all gone, John. Burned out. Looted. Looks like a wasteland. Those rumors that the posse and other gangs like it just tore it apart are true. Sick bastards. Another vibration, this one more pronounced. We're shutting one engine down, Danny shouted, looking back at John. We gonna crash? Lee asked. It can fly on one, Forrest replied. Not fast, but at least keep us going. John wondered if Maury even knew the proper procedure for shutdown while in flight, or whether this was a learn-on-the-job situation. For that matter, how would the helicopter's flight characteristics change, and could Maury handle it? Seconds later, he began to find out when it felt like the chopper falling out beneath them and Maury then pitching the nose forward. At least he had 1,000 feet of altitude to figure it out, but at their speed, that meant a matter of seconds. He could hear the difference in engine and rotor pitch, and then the additional strain on the one remaining engine as Maury pushed it to the max, finally leveling out just a few 100 feet above Interstate 40. Going against safety procedures, John unclipped from his harness and crawled forward. He didn't say a word to Maury, who was completely focused on keeping them aloft, Danny talking to him on the intercom, offering either some advice or just encouragement. John could see the airspeed indicator. They were down to 70. He was not sure if it was miles per hour or knots. I think I smell something burning, Forrest shouted, and John picked up the scent as well. What the hell was it? That's Hickory up ahead, Danny shouted. Still Indian country in places. We're trying for the Morganton Airport, which is 10 miles farther on. If it holds together, Forrest replied. The airport in Morganton is ours. Can we make it? My thoughts, Danny shouted. Hangar's still intact. Old Bob Gillespie still lives there. Used to work on choppers. Passing the outskirts of Hickory, flying low, they passed within easy landing distance of that far larger airport, but it was still an area not really secured, and as if in answer, there was a sharp rattling beneath them. Some bastard down there just hit us, Forrest announced. Thank God this isn't a Huey with no armor. I might have caught one in the ass. John crawled back to his seat and strapped back in, Danny shouting they were just minutes out if things held together. Crossing over narrow Lake Rodis, John could clearly see the Morganton Airport straight ahead, one long runway up on a slight bluff. Maury aimed straight for the middle of it, approaching the runway at a right angle, not bothering to swing out the few extra miles for a standard runway approach. He began to ease off the throttle, pulling in the collective, the nose flaring up, view forward changing to nothing but sky for John. He looked over at Lee, trying to offer a reassuring smile. His old friend and neighbor, a man with 6 generations of family history in their valley, a man he would want more than anyone else by his side in a fight, was definitely having a hard time with his first flight. In spite of the cold, sweat was beating down his face and his eyes were closed, his lips moving in silent prayer. Almost there, John shouted, putting a reassuring hand on his friend's shoulder. Lee simply nodded and then leaned forward to retch again. Brace yourselves! Danny shouted. Forrest leaned over to unlatch the side door and slide it open. The cold blast of air swirling in, a refreshing shock, washed out the stench of vomit and whatever it was that was burning. The landscape outside was tilted at a crazy angle. With a lurch, the helicopter banked sharply to port, and John was now looking nearly straight down at a runway 50 feet below. Maury straightened the wounded bird out, throttled back more, the ground coming up fast. There was a final blast from the rotor, slowing their rate of descent, and with nose high, he slammed down hard on the runway while still going forward. They bounced and came down again for another bounce, and then he cut power back so that with the third bounce, the wheels stayed on the ground. They were still rolling forward at a fair clip, Maury or Danny working the brakes, and they finally rolled to a stop.
"Out! Everyone out!"
Maury shouted. John was definitely not going to hesitate with that order. He reached over to help Lee, who was fumbling with his safety harness, the buckles slick with frozen vomit, so that John could not help but gag as he helped his friend to his feet and pushed him out the door. Command instinct told John that he should be the last one out. Forrest and Kevin, still acting as if the day were routine, were already unbuckled and out the door, while up forward, Maury and Danny fumbled at switches to shut the Black Hawk down. Maury looked back at John and motioned for him to get out. John needed no further urging, reaching over to pat Maury on the shoulder before exiting. Overhead, the rotor was still slowly spinning but winding down. As he stepped out, he was greeted by the smell of burned metal. Old training reminded him not to breathe deeply. Burning aluminum and titanium were toxic.
"Son of a bitch!"
Forrest cried, pointing at the portside turbine mounting.
"Either damn lucky bastards or damn good shots!"
The housing was scored with half a dozen deep dents, standing out clearly, the paint having been blown off. Black smoke was trailing out from the exhaust pipe, the northwesterly breeze whipping it around them. John covered his mouth to go up and look closer with Forrest by his side.
"None of the rounds penetrated?"
he asked.
"So what happened?" "Supposed to be proof even against 20-millimeter rounds, as long as they're not armor-piercing, but still, it dings the metal and bends it in. Sometimes fragments of bent metal pop off inside the engine housing and get whipped into the turbine. We most likely cracked the turbine blade. If we had shut down immediately, it wouldn't have been so bad. Now I'm not sure how much damage it did."
The rotor came to a stop, Danny exiting the aircraft, coming aft to join them, fire extinguisher in hand, reaching up high to hose down the intake and then exhaust ports. John stepped away from the Black Hawk, knees feeling rubbery. Lee was just lying in the snow, breathing deeply, looking up at the sky. John went up to his side and knelt down.
"John, we've been friends for Lord knows how many years," Lee gasped. "But I'll be damned if I ever go flying with you again. For that matter, I'll be damned if I ever go flying again, period."
Kevin Milady, who had knelt down on the other side of Lee, chuckled.
"Hey, that was a piece of cake."
"Kiss my butt,"
Lee gasped, before rolling onto his side and retching again. Maury finally climbed out of the cockpit, took off his helmet and tossed it back inside, and then, to John's surprise, he got sick to his stomach as well. John stood to one side, waiting for his friend to regain his composure, while aft, Forrest had climbed back inside to fetch another fire extinguisher to hand out to Danny, who continued to douse the engine. The smoke was subsiding, the aircraft's metal ringing with metallic pings as it cooled down.
"Here comes Bob Gillespie,"
Danny announced, and he pointed to a four-wheel all-terrain vehicle turning out from the taxiway and onto the runway. Its driver, an elderly man, capless and bald-headed, was slowing down to a near stop 100 feet out with shotgun at the ready.
"Who the hell are you crazy bastards?" he shouted.
Danny held his arms up, cursing back and identifying himself. The driver relaxed, set his shotgun down, and drove up, dismounting, reaching to the rear seat to pull out a heavy fire extinguisher and dragging it up behind the chopper.
"Danny McMullen, just what in hell are you doing out here?"
"We just went for a little ride."
Turning, he introduced the rest of the group. John had heard about Gillespie, who until the day owned the airport and spent his life fixing nearly anything that could fly. When contact was reestablished with Morganton back in the spring, Danny had tried to recruit Gillespie into moving to Black Mountain to help with the L-3 and Black Hawk. Gillespie had managed to survive by going hermit and lying low when the posse had been rampaging through the area. With no family, his wife having passed away years earlier, the airport had become his family. The old man merely nodded a reply to the introductions because he was all eyes for the Black Hawk. and without a word he slowly walked around it, taking a few minutes to look at the bullet-pocked turbine housing, poking his head into the cockpit, and clucking before finally going back to Danny.
"So which of you screwed up $6 million worth of aircraft?"
They all looked one to the other, and John started to step forward.
"I've seen more than one crash in my career, and by God, 10 minutes ago I figured I was about to see a bunch of fools die. That was without a doubt one of the most god-awful landings I have ever witnessed. Whoever was flying this, do us a favor and stay on the ground. You bent the wheel strut, you idiot."
As he spoke, he pointed to the port side strut, which was indeed cantered out at an angle, and John now noticed the chopper was actually listing.
"How about the engine?" Danny asked. "Don't know until I strip it down. Most likely some cracked turbine blades for starters. Let me guess, you kept them spinning after you got hit until things started to burn out."
Everyone looked over at Maury, who was suddenly red-faced.
"Damn it! Like I told you 6 months ago, it's been 20 years since I flew one of these things. At least we're still alive."
It was Forrest who broke the tension, reaching into his jacket pocket to pull out a pack of Dunhills. Popping one out, he then held it up, offering it to the others.
"Oh, my God!" Gillespie cried, reaching out for one.
"Can this guy maybe fix it?" John whispered, leaning over to Danny.
"Don't know until we strip the engine down. I think Forrest has something to trade for the work,"
John replied. Danny nodded, and to John's surprise, he went over to Forrest's side and motioned for a cigarette. A minute later, all of them, except for Lee and himself, were smoking, Maury now shaking from adrenaline and fatigue, nervously inhaling and coughing as he exhaled, but then continuing to smoke. Forrest looked over at John, again that seductive offer. He was standing downwind of his friends and, of course, breathing in the delicious scent. And then there was the memory of the photograph of Jennifer with her dying mother and the promise he made. While putting together the drop package, he had come upon the idea of including the photographs as proof of the validity of who he was if it was actually handed intact to Bob. Fishing around in the basement of what had once been Jen's house, he found the photo albums. Going through them had caused deep stabs of pain, and Michaela had found him thus, crying softly as he looked at the photos of Mary holding Elizabeth as a newborn, and then Jennifer. And as well, old photos going back to Mary's childhood, the day they announced their engagement, the day they got married. She had not said a word about finding him thus, accepting without question his comment that he was looking for a couple of photographs to enclose in the message capsule as proof of who he was if the situation was too dangerous for them to land. Looking out across the snow-covered landscape, still smelling the burning cigarettes, his friends unwinding and laughing, as men do after a close shave with disaster, he wondered where all of this was leading, and what his reception from Michaela would be when they finally got into downtown Morganton, made the long-distance phone call to Black Mountain, and found a way to get the last 40 miles back to home. I hope this was all worth it. His thoughts were more like a prayer. "Bob, for God's sake, I hope you are still alive. That whatever Quentin was raving about was just the memories of a dying man." He so wanted to believe it. That not only was Bob alive, but that he was on the side of Bluemont. The mere thought of him being on their side, a reassurance that, in spite of the tragedy of the spring, it was a government he could still work with. Chapter 6
"It's 7 days now without a word from Roanoke or anywhere else."
John sighed, looking over at Maury Hurt, who, along with several of the ham radio operators in their community, had been monitoring 122.9 around the clock. The response was silence.
"Could it be a signal couldn't carry that far?" John asked.
"It used to be an open channel for uncontrolled airspace," one of the hams replied. "With a handheld unit, I sometimes picked up traffic 60 miles away. The antenna I've got set up now picks up some distant chatter. Not sure from where, I suspect down toward Charleston, so we should have heard something."
"And we're certain it was monitored 24/7 at 15 minutes into each hour? No holes? No one asleep?"
The small group looked at each other, shaking their heads.
"John, we set up a regular rotation, at least 2 monitoring at any given time. 0. Zilch. Nothing."
"Okay, thanks for coming over," John sadly replied.
The four left his home, Michaela seeing them off and then coming back to sit next to John, who was gazing absently at the fire blazing inside the wood stove.
"Feel it was all for naught?" she asked.
He winced slightly as she took his left hand to examine it. He had lost a glove while leaning out of the chopper, and by the time he had finally arrived back home, his hand was completely numb with a touch of frostbite that was healing but still troublesome, along with the wrenched shoulder from getting slammed against the outside of the chopper. Michaela had hovered over him ever since their return, muttering in stern nurse manner about busted ribs and other assorted injuries from the past, with this new one now added in. The trip had drained him, again reminding him that he was no longer a young lieutenant or captain in the field. Those days were more than half a lifetime ago. Once home, Michaela held him in a fierce embrace, stifling back tears, whispering that when their return was long overdue, everyone had begun to fear the worst, that they had crashed, been shot down, or foolishly landed into a trap and taken prisoner. He was beyond grateful for her response, given the anger she was feeling when he left and the way she snuggled up close to him after feeding him some hot soup and then packing him off to bed for 12 blessed hours of sleep. A day later, another storm had rolled in, dropping an additional 10 inches. Before the day, such a storm, though significant for the South, was just part of life. Lifelong residents of the area were now saying it was beginning to look like the worst winter in decades. And given how precarious living now was, a long, snowy winter could indeed turn into a starving and freezing time. In the last 3 weeks, John calculated that he and Michaela had gone through 6 to 8 weeks' worth of firewood. With a baby due in just about 2 months, it was becoming another source of worry. He dreaded the hours of work splitting and stacking an extra cord of firewood. The other source of worry was the apparent loss, at least for some time to come, of their Black Hawk. Bob Gillespie was stripping down the damaged engine. One of the turbine blades had indeed fractured. The wreckage of the 3 helicopters destroyed in the battle around Asheville Mall back in the spring had been dragged into the old Sears building to get it out of the weather and still rested there. John had agreed to allocate yet more precious gas reserves for Danny and Maury to go to Asheville to see if replacement parts could be salvaged from the wrecks and then transported all the way down to Morganton. This apparently failed venture to try to get a message to Bob Scales had cost the community several 100 gallons of precious fuel already, along with the possible permanent loss of their captured Black Hawk. He had long ago learned to compartmentalize the multitude of issues and anxieties that had become part of his daily life, and he had to do so now, forcing a smile as Michaela gently massaged his still tender hand and then checked his shoulder, which was still sore as well. The room was quiet, warm. John sighed and leaned up to kiss her on the lips as she stood beside him.
"You know, this could kind of lead to something," he whispered, and she hugged him. Several seconds later, he received a solid kick from their baby. "And that little devil is a mood killer, if ever there was one, John Matherson," she laughed. "Maybe come spring we can get back to some fun."
He sighed, content to just hold her, both of them chuckling as the baby continued to squirm and kick. He finally looked down at his old-style wristwatch, hugged Michaela tightly, and then reluctantly stood up.
"I really should go up to the college. Ernie and the Hawkinses want to show me what they're up to."
She helped to bundle him up, went into the kitchen, and came back with a quart mason jar of canned peaches, stuffing the bottle into his pocket.
"That poor girl nursing twins needs these more than I do right now. Send her my love and tell her once it's safe to walk, I'll come up to check on her."
She watched as he went out the door, calling for him to stay in the middle of the road in case he fell. Maury had brought word to them this morning that one of the Wilson boys had been found dead the day before. Out hunting, he apparently slipped on some ice, fell, compound fractured his leg, and lay there helpless until he bled out and froze. In the few years prior to the day, when cell phones had become a part of everyone's daily lives, such an accident was all but unheard of. If in trouble while out in the woods, one simply called and cried out for help. Falling where no one could see or hear you replaced the worry last summer about the plague of copperheads and rattlesnakes that had erupted in the area, at least a dozen getting bitten and, with no antidote, 2 children dying. warmly wrapped up, wearing a scarf which he had always disdained before, but was now grateful that Michaela had wrapped one of hers around his neck, he trudged down to Montreat Road by the abandoned tennis courts and headed north for what used to be a short hike up to the campus. In a different time, he would have soaked in yet another beautiful morning after a snowstorm. No wind had followed the storm down here in the narrow valley, the trees canopying the road bent under the heavy weight of the wet snow forming a tunnel-like vista ahead of him. A couple of heavy branches had snapped off, which he had to climb over, a barrier that road crews once took care of within minutes. To his right, Flat Creek was still roiling downstream through the park where he used to take his children to play. A couple of students were down there enjoying the morning, laughing, the girl chasing the young man, tackling him. The two, not suspecting someone might be watching, rolling together, laughing, and then kissing passionately. He smiled as he surreptitiously watched for a moment, again aware of the desire he had felt for Michaela just moments ago, and then, seeing where their frolic might lead, he figured it best to quietly move along. Even in the midst of death, there was still life, and young life. He recalled a favorite science fiction series, Battlestar Galactica, when after the near annihilation of the human race, survivors aboard a few remaining ships fled their home worlds. A fierce debate ensued, with one character demanding that they make a final fight, while the newly appointed president declared they should flee, and that if there was a priority now, it was to have children. Lots of children. In the midst of death, life was again trying to reassert itself. The historian in him knew such was true. After every brutal, annihilating war, the primal instinct was to repopulate, to replace with a new generation all those who had been lost. It made him think of Jennifer. She'd be 14 and a half now, no longer his little girl, on the cusp of becoming a young woman. The baby would be Michaela's first child, but for him, in a symbolic way, was the baby about to be born a replacement for the one he had lost? He glanced back at the couple in the snow, definitely behaving like a young couple in love, ignoring the coldness of the snow for a moment, this next glance telling him it was definitely time to move along. A wisp of a sad, understanding smile creased his features as he pushed on, leaving the secluded park behind, reaching the road bridge over Flat Creek, walking up the steep slope past what was now the community's source of electricity. To his right was Anderson Auditorium, converted into the town factory for turning out turbines, generators, and wire, the fundamental building blocks of late 19th and early 20th century technology. He felt he should drop in to at least say hello, but he realized those working away inside the factory might see it as some sort of inspection tour and be thrown off their routine, and he therefore pressed on. The road steepened for 50 yards or so, memories flooding in of one icy day when classes were dismissed early, and he wound up driving down it sideways, laughing students helping to push him out of the ditch where he had finally come to a stop. It was distressing to realize now that this short walk up a slope, trudging through nearly 2 feet of snow, left him so winded that he had to stop for a moment to catch his breath. As he rested, he turned to look around at his valley. After a snowstorm, all sound was all so muffled. When still living near Ridgecrest, he delighted in the fact that the distant rumble on Interstate 40 ceased for a day or so during and after a storm. From childhood, there were memories of the sound of the few cars still on the road, tires wrapped in chains for traction, rattling by, and, blessing of blessings, days off from school. Now, except for the distant sound of hammering from Anderson Auditorium, all was silent. Whoever had penned Silent Night knew and understood it, as did Robert Frost when he wrote about stopping in the woods on a snowy evening. It used to be his favorite time of year. It no longer was, with all the worries about survival to spring for his family and community. The worry was compounded by the unanswered questions. Was Bob Scales still alive? Had Bob indeed sent one man on a desperate journey to reach him, and if so, why? And overarching all were Quentin's dying words about EMPs, the obsessive question haunting him. Were they ramblings of a delirious man slipping into death, or a dire warning? The thoughts of that terminated his moment of peaceful contemplation, and with breath somewhat back to normal, he turned to climb the last few hundred yards to the library.
Rounding the corner of the road by the chapel and the library, he was amused to see some of the students out sledding. Beyond their work schedule and rotation periods as community guards with the militia companies, the fact that they still had energy to enjoy such a beautiful winter day was, to him, a testament to the resilience of youth. Going through the darkened entryway to the library, he was greeted by the musty scent of tens of thousands of books that, for the last couple of years, had been exposed to no temperature control and runaway moisture. The Hawkins' living quarters in the back corner were blocked off with several layers of plastic sheets, and once through the swinging doors to the rear office, he was greeted with cheery warmth. Becca looked up at him, smiled, and put a finger to her lips. He looked over to the cribs where the twins were tucked in, fast asleep. She smiled and offered him a chair by the wood stove that they had installed, which was giving off a cheery warmth. "Just got the little ones down at the same time for once," she announced, and without asking, she scooped a ladle of soup from a kettle on the fire, dipped it into a bowl, and offered it to John, who politely took it. Old southern customs of greeting a guest with food still held, even now. The soup was watery thin. There was a hint of some kind of meat in it, wild onions, and he wasn't really sure what else. They chatted for a few minutes about the babies, who were thriving, John remembering to pull from his jacket the canned peaches, which she clutched with gratitude. Finished with the soup, he asked about the guys, and laughing, she pointed to the staircase to the basement. "Those computers and all the other stuff have nearly turned me into a widow. Do me a favor and order Ernie to get the heck out of here at day's end and for Paul to remember he has a wife." "Will do," John replied with a smile, and he headed for the basement, which had been renamed the Wizard's Workshop. A joke that few caught was that long ago it was the name for Tom Edison's lab in Menlo Park, where he developed the incandescent light bulb and helped trigger the electrical revolution of the 19th century that they were struggling to restore. As John opened the basement door, he was surprised by the profligate use of electricity. The room was now brightly lit with fluorescent lights. He had always hated that type of illumination, but it used less juice than a standard incandescent bulb. A wood stove had been rigged into the basement, so it was no longer a damp, bone-chilling room. And, indeed a wonder, a dehumidifier was humming away. The stench of mold had at least abated somewhat as a result. 6-foot stacks of magazines still cluttered most of the room, but a work area had been cleared in the far quarter, additional workbenches dragged over from classrooms and offices around the campus. Piled up around the benches were several dozen old computers, half a dozen more Apple IIe's, early PCs, Commodore 64s, old Gateways, Dells, and half a dozen other models. Ernie, with Paul by his side, was hunched over a green computer board, and as John came up behind them, Ernie grunted out a curse and tossed the board to one side. "Cooked, damn it. I would have liked to have had that one." "How's it going?" John asked the two, obviously so intent on their work they had not heard him approach. "Good and bad," Ernie grumbled without bothering to look back at John as he picked up another board from a pile on the table and started to examine it. "We've got half a dozen machines cobbled together," Paul offered in a far cheerier voice. He pointed to the restored computers off to one side, and John went over to examine them. 3 were Apples, one of them an early Mac with its ridiculously small blue-screen monitor, beside them a couple of 1980s PCs and a Commodore 64. The 64 was turned on, the old television it was hooked to flickering, a popular fantasy adventure game of the 80s running, little stick figures being chased by a stick-figure dragon. While in college, John remembered, he had splurged on buying an Atari 2600 game machine, he and his friends consuming endless beers while driving 2 tanks around an obstacle field and shooting at each other. It had triggered the first fight with Mary, who became fed up that he was spending more time on that damn game than with her. He hated to disturb the two at what was obviously an obsessive task, but he felt he had to. Paul had been absent from the factory ever since the discovery of a functional computer. It was at least keeping Ernie busy and out of his hair, but still, Ernie's skills could perhaps be better devoted to working with the ham radio operators or helping as well with the production of generators and alternators to provide power to their ever-expanding state of Carolina.
Ernie and Paul were both hunched over a computer board, wearing magnifying glasses, absorbed with testing the board, quietly arguing whether it was fried or just one chip was bad. "Mind if I interrupt?" John finally asked.
"In a minute,"
Ernie replied without looking up, overriding Paul's objections as he pried a chip off the board, fished a replacement out of a plastic tray, and snapped it in.
"There!"
Ernie announced, pointing to a voltmeter that surged to life once the chip was replaced.
"It's good to go. We can use it."
John sighed. "I hate to do this, but can I ask what we can use that board for?" The two looked up at him as if he was a peasant rudely interrupting a royal banquet.
"If we can just get some computers back online, it's a huge step,"
Ernie announced, still wearing his magnifying glasses, which gave him something of a crazed look when you were staring straight at him.
"For what purposes that we can use right now?" John asked, regretting that his query did sound somewhat blunt.
"All right, John, we'd better settle this priority right now," Ernie replied sharply.
"I'm just asking where this can lead us, that's all," John said defensively.
"You two are a couple of our most valuable resources. I just want to make sure we're spending those resources wisely."
"You suggesting I go out on a woodcutting detail instead?" Ernie snapped.
"No, damn it!" Paul stepped between the two and put his hands up in a soothing gesture.
"John's right, Ernie. We're spending a lot of time on these old machines. There has to be a profit in it. And he has a right to know what we're thinking about regarding all of this."
"All right, then," Ernie retorted. "God knows how many times when I was with IBM or contracted to NASA, I'd be working on something and some damn project manager would come along, question its worth, and shelve it. IBM could have been years ahead of Apple and the whole PC revolution if people like me had been listened to."
"Let me take this," Paul said softly, sensing that Ernie was heating up.
"Fine," Ernie snapped. "But if our supreme leader is here to tell us to shut this down, I'll just hole up at home and keep at it myself. My family and I survived through the first year without the interference of others, and, John, you were damn glad to have us blocking the left flank on the day we fought the posse."
"Why don't you three arguing fools come upstairs for some tea and talk it out up here?"
They looked back to where Becca stood at the base of the stairs, holding a teapot up as a peace offering. John nodded a bit sheepishly and followed her back up to the sunlit warmth of the old library office. The twins were still asleep, so after gratefully accepting the herbal mint drink, John followed Paul out into the main area of the library. It was cold, but one corner of the vast room was sunlit and offered the comfort of overstuffed leather chairs. The three settled down.
"I know the machines we are working on look like toys," Paul began. "Compared to what we had just before the war, they are toys, but in their day they were cutting-edge technology and used as such. Funny that we never thought about it before. The vast majority of computers being tossed aside were not broken. It was just that advances were coming so rapidly. It's not like old cars that got sold and resold until they finally just died. Most computers getting junk simply just had a hard drive cook-off or a motherboard going bad, but the rest of the unit was still good. They were just junked with no resale in mind because after 3 to 4 years, they were antiques. Moore's Law at work."
"Refresh my memory, please," John asked. Ernie sighed as if asked a dumb question by someone who should know better. Paul said, "Moore's Law, named after one of the founders of Intel back in the 1960s, postulated that computing power, as defined by the number of transistors per square inch, will double in a very rapid progression. It meant that computing power, speed of calculations, storage, all of it, would increase at a geometric progression, while at the same time cost per unit, such as a hard drive, for example, will plummet. That Apple IIe we first brought online had around 64K, not megabytes or gigabytes, but 64 kilobytes worth of chips in it for around $3,000 in 1980s money. 8 years later, it was obsolete and thus wound up in the basement down here, and I bet in Black Mountain alone we could find a couple of hundred of them, not plugged in on the day things hit the fan, and therefore perhaps still viable. Imagine if we had 200 of your old clinker Edsels. Unlike computers, they were run and resold until finally just junked. Not so with computers, and that is what has Ernie and me fired up. Your average $500 computer just before the war wiped out nearly everything that was hooked up online was equal to the military's top cray of a couple of decades earlier."
"Therefore?" John pressed.
That's the whole interesting point that we all seem to overlook, Paul continued. I remember the year the college purchased new laptops for every faculty and staff member. Great idea, but 3 years later they were obsolete. 5 years later they were in our junk pile or just tossed into a closet and forgotten. I remember seeing a whole dumpster load of them, recalling when they cost a couple of $100,000 on delivery, and 5 years later we couldn't give them away, so we just tossed them out instead. There was no secondary market for 5, let alone 8 or 10-year-old computers. Files once stored on 5-inch floppy disks, or even reel-to-reel, were transferred to 3.5-inch disks, and then to just memory sticks, downloaded into the hard drive of your new machine, and the old machine's tossed. Those files are still alive, John, but we've got to dig up the hardware to read them again and then build off that.
Build what?
I'm worried about having enough food and firewood to see us through the winter. Everyone is screaming for more electricity now that we've got something up and running again. Hey, I'd love to have a computer in my office, even an old green screen machine hooked to a printer. I'm sick of my old Underwood typewriter with the dang F and J keys sticking half the time. But the time to get even one computer up and running, especially now? He pointed to the blowing snowdrifts outside the window, and a thought flashed of the young couple down in the park. He wondered if the cold had finally driven them back inside. It's stuff we can use now, databases for one, Paul replied. We were lucky to find hard copies of all the IEEE journals from the 19th century, so we could figure out how to start rebuilding using the same designs Westinghouse, Tesla, and Edison did. It'd be nice to have all those millions of words in a searchable database. Even the library cataloging went online years ago, so we are no longer even sure what we have in the book stacks around us. And that would help us... John let the question trail off. Okay, I agree, Paul continued. A computer working here, one in Asheville, another in Morganton. Big deal other than the convenience of using writing machines we once took for granted. To talk with others, we already have some telephones up and running, cell phones and Wi-Fi. Forget it for years to come. So, yeah, I can see your point on that score. I agree our more immediate concerns are firewood and food. I'm not saying stop working on this, John interjected. It's just that, as of the moment, I'm not seeing the short-term benefits. We replicate computer technology of the 1980s, maybe the 90s, and then what? We eavesdrop, Ernie said with a smile, acting at least somewhat non-confrontational for a change. Like I said the other day when Paul showed you the first machine up and running. Come on, John, I'm talking about Bluemont, your ex-military. When you were in the Middle East, how did the White House and Pentagon micromanage every move you guys made?
Commodore 64s and Apple IIe's, John replied with a cynical smile. Not much better, actually, if you go back a few years. When Linda and I were writing software for Apollo, its guidance systems were 40K computers. 40K! Think of it. We went to the moon on 40-kilobyte computers. Ernie sighed and looked out the window at the snow-covered lawn in front of the library. America did that in the 60s, and it seems crazy today. The first shuttle flights had little more than a meg on board. All that data going back and forth on something your cell phone, at least before the system fried off, trumped 1,000 times over. Again, Moore's Law. So with what you are doing downstairs, you think you can hack into Bluemont's communications? How? First of all, the data goes up and down. SATCOM. Even low-Earth orbit satellites are super hardened against EMPs generated by the sun, coronal mass ejections. For military use, hardened against EMP hits as well. But a lot of that stuff goes all the way up to geosync orbit. How did you get your television before the crap hit the fan? John started to smile.
An 18-inch dish.
Exactly.
But it's encrypted, isn't it?
It all comes down to zeros and ones in the end, John. When Linda and I left IBM, we set up our own business, writing software and providing some of the precision hardware for large array tracking dishes. Mostly civilian business contracts, but a few overseas governments as well. Recall a scandal a few years back of a high government official with an unsecured server in their home that was hacked by some guys in Poland, Romania, somewhere overseas? John had some recollection of it. So much of what happened before the day, which had once seemed all so important, was now becoming hazy memories.
John, you remember this college was starting on a cybersecurity major before the war started. He nodded with memory of that. President Hunt had even asked him, as an historian and ex-military, to think about creating a course on the history of technology. The idea had intrigued him, and he had even done some preliminary research into the fascinating history of World War II,
the tales about Enigma, Ultra,
the tapping into Japanese and German radio traffic, the work of the legendary Turing and the team at Bletchley Park, England. Is that where these two were leading?
Take me to the conclusion, John said, looking out across the windswept yard in front of the campus library.
Lowering clouds were sweeping in from the northwest, a light sprinkling of snow flurries swirling down. If another storm was coming in, he wanted to get home, split some more wood, and huddle in close to the wood stove with Michaela before it hit. Remember those huge satellite dishes folks used to have in front of their homes 20 years ago? Ernie asked, pressing in. John chuckled. It was a bit of a stereotype of ramshackle trailers with a dish half as big as the trailer planted in the front yard for television. They nearly all disappeared once the big mainstream servers came in with an 18-inch dish you could tack to your living room window. John nodded, remembering installing one himself when he and Mary moved here with 2 young girls. 100+ channels to choose from, and he had visions of all the educational programs that could be offered, rather than what most stations had degenerated into with the advent of the nauseating reality show craze. If I could get my hands on some of those big old dishes, which hopefully were offline and disconnected on the day, and cobble together parts that were not cooked off, I think in a few weeks I could be tapping into communications traffic.
Of
Bluemont, for starters, Ernie replied enthusiastically. Raw reportage from BBC uplinking and downlinking out of Canada, even the Chinese. They still must be using ComSat systems. You just point, listen, download, and evaluate.
Just?
You make it sound easy, Ernie. So you got gigs of data flying around, and chances are the stuff we want to know about is highly encrypted. They're no fools.
No chain is stronger than its weakest link.
No data is foolproof. Turing built a system from scratch and was able to break down the German codes, looking for patterns of usage coming from those German Enigma machines that supposedly could be programmed to create billions of variables and thus thought to be uncrackable. Come on, historian, how did we figure out the Japanese were going to hit us at Midway in June 1942?
John smiled at such an easy underhand pitch.
You know as well as I do if you ask the question.
Paul, do you know?
John looked over at his electrical wizard, who had once been a student, and was surprised to see the quizzical look and shake of a head.
I remember you being in my World War II class, Paul.
Sorry, sir, I was diverted a lot that year, he replied, smiling. John remembered how Paul and Becca had shared the same class and spent most of it staring at each other.
All right, then. We were picking up radio chatter about a Target X, indicating the Japanese were preparing for a massive naval strike. One of the cryptanalyst guys at Pearl Harbor came up with the idea of Midway Island sending out a report that their desalinization plant to provide fresh water on the island was offline and they were desperate, the message to be sent via a code we knew the Japanese had already cracked. The message was sent, and only hours later, radio traffic from Japan was monitored that extra desalinization equipment would have to be shipped to Target X once taken. Bingo. We knew where their next offensive would hit. We had our carriers waiting to receive them and wiped out their carriers in a surprise counterstrike. It is a textbook example of code-breaking changing the course of a war.
How many kids from this school's old cybersecurity program are still here? Ernie asked.
I'm not sure, John sighed. Too many of his students were now long gone, killed in the fighting or dead from disease and malnourishment. Those left were serving in the community's defense force, working in the ever-expanding electrical parts factory down in Anderson Hall, or assigned to other equally crucial tasks.
If I could pull in 4 or 5, even just 2 or 3, and put them to work to help me, Ernie pressed, with Paul nodding in eager agreement.
John, I just might be able to get something useful out of our tinkering in the basement.
Just imagine if you had known Fredericks's orders before that piece of trash even came to Asheville.
Ernie pressed in with his argument.
Hell, for all we know, 500 troops with more choppers could be on their way here right now, and we are clueless until they arrive.
Or suppose what that poor guy Reynolds said is true, Paul interjected, that something is up regarding another EMP. Who is thinking about it? Why? When? Do you want the answers, or do we sit back passively and wait?
John looked back and forth at the two, and then back out the window at what was obviously another storm coming on. He sighed and finally nodded.
Okay, you got it.
The two broke into grins, the elderly Ernie and young Hawkins high-fiving each other.
Quietly, and I mean quietly, run a query today. If any of our old students were in our cybersecurity program, pull them off whatever they are working on now. I then want this building secured. Tell Kevin Milady and Grace Freeman I want a guard on here henceforth. Nothing overt, just that we learned with our encounter with Fredericks that he did have spies inside our community. If we're going for something like this, I don't want it broadcasted all over town.
John, we'd be a lot more secure if we moved this entire operation over to my place,
Ernie replied.
Why so?
Simple. It is out of the way of prying eyes. Easier to maintain security. Plus, my diagnostic tools are there. I can run things 24/7 at my place. Come on, it's the logical choice.
John hesitated as he thought it over and then just simply nodded.
Your place then, Ernie. I'm not going to mention this to our council. We keep it under wraps for a while. The kids stay at your place.
He hesitated and then smiled.
You house them and you feed them as well. That will justify their being pulled off of regular work details.
To his surprise, Ernie did not object to that additional requirement.
You two got that?
There were eager nods. He sighed, wrapped his scarf tightly around his neck, put on his old forage cap that looked like a relic from the Civil War, stood up and started for the door. Once he was outside, the cold was a bracing shock, the snow coming down hard, so that he pulled his hat brim low to protect his eyes. He shuffled down the path out to the middle of the road, trying to let all the concerns of his life slip away at least for a few minutes. The weather was triggering so many memories. As he walked against the renewed snowfall, he found himself recalling a time when, as a boy, a storm like this would send him out hiking up to the South Mountain Reservation a few miles away from where he lived to find a favorite secluded spot in a pine grove. Knowing the reservation patrol officers were nowhere about on such a day, he'd build a fire and enjoy the snowfall, youthful imagination taking hold, that he was a sentry for General Washington, posted along that low ridgeline to keep an eye on the British over in Manhattan. But now, he simply longed to be back at his home for the rest of the day, sitting by the wood stove with Michaela. Unfortunately, without any scotch to sip or cigarette to enjoy, but at least there was her company awaiting. He glanced over at the park along Flat Creek as he stepped out onto Montreat Road and chuckled softly. He couldn't see the amorous young couple, but there was a plume of wood smoke swirling up from within a grove of trees, and he smiled with the assumption that the two were nestled in there, enjoying the storm and solitude while being together. He shuffled on in silence, turning up the steep hill to his house above the old tennis courts, glad to see smoke rising from the chimney. Stamping the snow off his boots, he stepped inside and was surprised to see Maury Hurd in the sunroom, Michaela by his side.
"John, where in the hell have you been?"
Maury asked excitedly. "What's wrong?"
"It's Bob Scales," Maury announced with a grin. "We just got a message. He wants to meet."
Chapter 7 John slowly read the message again, out loud, looking around at the nearly dozen men and women crammed into what had once been the office of the president of the college. "I lament the sad news of the loss of our beloved Jay. I recall a day in May when I last talked to her, the same date in May that holds different connotations now. My friend, please return so that we can meet and discuss so many things of importance to both of us." He put the transcript down and looked around the room.
"And that is it?" Reverend Black asked. "Just that?"
"I think it is fake," Ernie stated, arms folded across his chest.
I don't, John replied.
Why?
Ernie's query was picked up by several others in the overcrowded room. Jay is obviously my Jennifer. The day in May, he knew that was Jennifer's birthday. We were on the phone talking when the EMP hit, thus his reference to connotations that others held regarding that day of days. It is something only Bob and I knew, a code to tell me it was really him, but tapped out in Morse code, for heaven's sake, with a preface to first switch to a different frequency to receive the message, that in Morse code as well? Billy Tyndall snapped. It's like some bad movie. Apparently it had been going out for several days until one of our ham listeners even realized it wasn't just interference and remembered enough to start copying it down. Why not voice? What is this, 1941 or something? How many people even know Morse code today?
Maybe that's the point, Maury said in response. Who knows how many people saw the dropped message before it got into Bob's hands?
If this Bob is even alive, is he someone we can trust? Forrest growled.
John sighed and looked at the old Underwood typewriter resting on his desk, absently tapping the F key to see if his tinkering with it had solved the problem. The damn thing still continued to jam. Let's add in this latest news from the BBC, John now added. All correspondents within the territory of the United States to be deported because of an alleged breach of national security.
BBC? England? Perhaps our only ally left in this crazy world? Something is up. We all know that, but what?
And do you think your friend, if still alive, holds the answer?
Anyone have a better suggestion? John asked.
If so, put it out there.
He looked around the room. Most just sat with heads lowered. Maury was shaking his head.
I've got to take the chance and meet him.
Back up there? How? Maury snapped. Gillespie thinks he can replace the coolant line, which was damaged as well, in a week or so. But the turbine blade is proving to be a real problem. But then what? Fly in? After being shot at last time and expect the red carpet treatment?
John, you and the rest of this council can order me to go, and I'll tell you to kiss off for your own good.
Maury looked over at Forrest for support.
I only go into a hot LZ once, John. No repeat trips. I'm with Maury on this.
And the fuel, Danny McMullen added. We burned through a lot of Jet A just going up there and back. I thought the intent was we keep that fuel in reserve in case we ever needed the Black Hawk for defense here. Even if they are ready to kiss our butts when landing, will they refuel us? John, they'll seize that chopper as stolen government property, and if we're ever let go, it will be one hell of a long walk back home.
John looked over at Michaela, who insisted upon attending this meeting, and saw her nod of approval. The room fell silent again, the only sound that of hammering and sawing from the adjoining chapel, where half a dozen students were at work, still laboring to restore it to what it had once been before being partially destroyed during the fighting back in the spring. John took it all in and realized if he put it to a vote, no one would support his going. This was one of those times he wished he had not relinquished the power he once held as virtual dictator of this community during the first year after the attack. He returned his gaze to Michaela, who sat in stoic silence, but her glance in reply said everything. Like most women in their final months of pregnancy, she held the trump card with her husband, if he in any way cared for his wife.
All right, he finally said with a sigh.
Alternatives? This guy, if he is real, is trying to reach out to you, Reverend Black said, forcing a smile to try to ease the moment. If real, he tried to reach out to you with that tragic messenger. Now this cryptic reply in Morse code. Those two methods, Black paused for a moment, tell me that there is some important reason behind this entire affair, and he wants to keep his cards close, perhaps even from those around him. Acknowledge receipt of the message, counter with some alternative.
If it is so all damn important, tell him to come here, Forrest snapped.
Why not? Black intervened. Forrest is onto something. Tell him to come here. The answer was so simple and obvious. As he contemplated it, John found himself wondering why he had not thought of that first. Perhaps a touch of the old hierarchy of command still held sway within him. When a general summoned a colonel to a meeting, it was, "Yes, sir, where and what time do we meet, sir?" And that was it. John smiled and nodded. "Okay, I'll go for that. How and where?" "Asheville?" Frank Nelson, now the mayor of that town, suggested. John shook his head. "Too public. A helicopter coming in there just might spook folks who survived the fighting back in the spring to take a pot shot at it." "The Asheville airport, then?" Frank pressed. "We disabled the runway," Black interjected, "and it means an overflight of all our territory around here. Chance for a good recon if he is not on the up and up."
989, Danny said quietly.
"What?" John replied, not sure what he meant. "Old FAA designations for airports. All airports in public use were given a three-letter code. CLT for Charlotte, AVL for Asheville. Shiflet is an old grass strip airport in Marion, which is our territory. You come in over the mountains to the north, and there it is. No overflight of our territory."
"Then why not Morganton?" Maury asked.
"Our disabled chopper is there," Danny replied. "Even though it's in a hangar, if he or the people with him poke around and see that and then they try to take it back, it would become a confrontation. Even if they don't try to take it back, they'll know our bird is down. Also, if they are planning some sort of nasty surprise, bringing in a lot of troops aboard an old C-130, we're not offering them a big paved strip. Strip down, they can land at Shiflet. But take off with all that snow on the ground?" He chuckled. "They can land, but then try to take off. If we see a C-130 coming in that can carry up to 100 troops, we just bogey off and leave them stuck in the snow."
"Shiflet would be ideal, John. Couple of dozen hangars, most of them ramshackle affairs like out of the 1930s. We put some heavily armed people in there as backup if they try to pull any stunts with a couple of choppers. Hell, we might even pick up an extra bird or two if they try any crap. Plus, 989, you transmit that on Morse code. Some geek listening in might not even recognize it and figure it is code for something else. I say 989 Shiflet."
John looked around the room and finally saw nods of agreement. "All right, then. Send out a response on the new frequency they shifted to. Ernie, can you and Danny figure it out? Something like 989 a date and then Zulu time and see what the response is.
And if they reply no deal, we go to meet them?"
"Politely tell them to go to hell," Michaela replied sharply.
On the walk back from the meeting, John held Michaela tightly by his side to ensure she did not slip and fall.
"You aren't trusting this, are you?" he asked.
She laughed softly. "I never understood just how much a pregnancy can mess up one's thinking. I want my husband by my side when the baby comes. I want him by my side as our baby goes through all those moments that then follow. The first smile, the first belly laugh, the first crawl, the first step, then the little hellion running amok around the house, and then one day..."
She paused and began to choke up.
"Damn it, I was never this way before, John. Yeah, someday if this world ever turns sane again, that we watch our child graduate from college. Your college, and still are together when they one day come through the doorway carrying their child, our child, the same way you look at Elizabeth and her toddler. I want that, and anything that might snatch it away fills me with dread."
She struggled to hold back her tears.
"You heard Elizabeth after the father of her child was killed,"
Michaela continued, and now the tears were flowing.
"Bringing a child into the world with the baby's father dead, the way she would cry herself to sleep at night, the time she would look at her boy and we could sense she could see the boy's father being there, but he was not and never will be. Don't get me wrong. Her husband, Seth, is an incredible, decent young man, the spitting image of his father, Lee. The fear she carries now is that something will happen to Seth the same as it did to Ben. I carry that same fear. At least the idea of this mythical friend of yours coming here alleviates some concern. But even then, what if it's a trap? Let's just say that rather than your friend coming in to meet you, it's half a dozen of those attack helicopters, or for that matter, some plane loitering at 30,000 feet, and they pinpoint your being at this remote airport and drop one of those fuel-air bombs I hear people talking about, or even one of those neutron bombs as payback for what you did to Fredericks. If they really wanted me dead, they would have taken this place off the map months ago. That's why I have to believe that Bob Scales is real, most likely in command of the forces up in Roanoke, and is trying to reach out to me, perhaps to prevent further bloodshed. It still makes me anxious.
He did not reply that it filled him with the same concerns and fears. If there was no reason for anxiety, if Scales was indeed alive, the overture to meet would have been overt, out in the open, not like this. Whatever the reason, he did know one thing for certain. He had to find out the truth, and find out now.
Chapter 8 The Blackhawk, which had crested over Linville Gorge just a few minutes earlier, came sweeping in low over frozen Lake James, crossed over the railroad bridge that spanned the Catawba River where it emptied into the lake, and came sweeping down the length of the snow-covered runway at well over 100 miles an hour. John shaded his eyes against the glare of the early morning sun, watching as it raced in, scanning it carefully with a pair of field glasses, feeling a touch of nostalgic pride at the sight of the chopper, painted in faded desert camo, taking him back to the desert of Iraq so long ago when, filled with awe, he watched scores of them sweeping out ahead of his armored battalion. He spared a quick glance to Forrest, who was watching intently, silently, wondering what this torn-up veteran of Afghanistan was feeling at the sight and sound of a machine that meant that friends were overhead, ready to protect